Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living with Jay and Annie Warmke. We're talking about sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
And today we're going to talk about the philosophy of enough. Philosophy of enough. And that's probably all we need to say about that. That's enough, right? So Annie, this is a concept that's going to be very strange to people and foreign to most Americans. So tell me, what are you talking about when you think about enough?
Some days I have no clue. I'm totally confused. But most days I know wealth is an illusion. And how we measure everything that we possess and use as resources, we only seem to count wealth as how much money we have and maybe some of our stuff being really valuable. We don't count the valuable things like the trees that we have on our land or the critters that walk the land. We don't measure the happiness that we have in our lives with our friends and community and children or our spiritual practices. So we have a lot of categories that we could measure as wealth, but we don't do it in this culture. And one of the stories that I know you like to tell is how you came to the idea of enough in a lot of ways. So,
well, before you get into that, I guess maybe we should back up because our situation was such that we were kind of living what people would consider the American dream. You know, we're all told that is the if you work hard, you can accumulate lots of stuff, and in the accumulating of stuff, you have this sense of security, you have a sense of position in society.
Power.
Power, and power is money, and he who dies with the most toys wins, and all of that. And we were in that position where we were earning quite a lot of money, doing the corporate lifestyle down in Florida. And then Annie decided to throw a wrench into the cogs of this illusion. So you want to, now that I've interrupted your story, go back to the story.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. There you are.
Well, I think the story started a long time ago, though, and we'll talk about that later. But for me, I had a very different idea about wealth. And in those days, I wasn't thinking about the term wealth. I was just thinking that I wanted more out of life than how much money there was. And we did a good job of managing what we had. We were good at investing in others and investing in our community, and our work was very worthwhile. But things change, you know, life's constant and it's change. And so as the government in this country changed, as we've moved closer over the last 37 years that you and I have been together to just totally consumption society, it forced us to make some changes. And so I don't know, it was like 18 years ago or so, we had taken our granddaughter, who was small, to Europe, and we were there on business, and we took the train from Paris to Spain, and then we were going to go hiking on this mountain. So we're standing at this ski lift, and I had been worrying about this the whole time we were traveling because when we were doing our business in Paris, you were very distracted, and you kept saying, "Where are you going today?" Well, I was goofing off, and then you'd say, "I think I'll go with you," which is something you had never, ever, ever done. And I kept looking into your face going, "Whoa, there's some real changes going on, and I wonder where he's coming from." So we're standing at the ski lift talking to two women who had moved to Barcelona, Spain from somewhere else, I don't remember, another country, and they were teaching business English. And when they finished talking, I looked at you and I said, "I'm going to slap myself in the mouth for saying this, but you've got to quit your job. It's sucking your soul." And what did you say?
Yeah, well, I won't say what I said, but it was essentially, "Oh, crap."
That's a really good translation.
You said it out loud. Yes. And that was kind of the beginning of deconstructing.
But wait a minute. Then you said something else.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, my first reaction, which is fairly typical being a good American, is if I quit my job, what happens? What's next? What do I do? Mm-hmm. Where is the money coming from? Where is the security? What about our health insurance? What about our retirement plan? What about our 401k? You know, all of these things sort of race through your mind like this is what provides you with that warm, fuzzy blanket that will protect you from all of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And you responded that
you didn't have a choice and that it was all an illusion and that you could lose your job tomorrow and there would be none of those things that you felt were so powerful and giving you such comfort. And I really believe that, and I think that's really where enough comes in, is to say, look, we have, and from the beginning, we had a strong relationship, a strong partnership, so we had the basis of everything we needed to move forward. And we also had a lot of skill sets. We had other resources besides that job. We had saved money. We knew people. We had great friends. We had people who were committed to who we were as human beings. And so we had this whole bank account that was plenty. It was enough. But we hadn't tested it yet. And so at that point, we left Europe and we said, we've got a plan. And that plan meant you were going to quit your job. I was going to quit my job first to get us ready. You were going to quit your job. And we were going to leave the United States for a while so we could watch America from across the pond. And then 9/11 happened, and it was a really great thing that we had decided to erase the past in our lives and move forward.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, gloss over that it's an easy thing to do, because none of this is easy. And if you're thinking about in your own life that this pursuit of more, you know, we talk about America as the philosophy of more, that this pursuit of more is going to be an easy thing to get out of, because it is tough. All of the messages in our society keep drawing you back into this.
Into the consumption.
Yeah. And in fact, I think about it sometimes that, you know, in the long past, how would an individual define themselves? How would society define you? And you would be a farmer, or you would be a carpenter, or
be
you would
what
be
you
a
produced.
Banker. Well, you're what you are or what you produce. Yeah. Well, today we refer to people as consumers. You know, you are what you consume. And our whole society views your value as what you will consume.
But there are places that, like China, for example, that have a rating system based on your charge card and what you buy with that charge card and where you eat and what your friends and family purchase and eat. And so I don't really want to live in a place where, and I don't mean like in China, but I don't want to live in an environment where that's all I'm measured by. I want to be able to measure myself. And one of the things that happened, which was very interesting, when we made the decision to really leave our old life, we often refer to it as our other life, and move to a position of having enough and trying to understand what that meant for us and not dipping back into the consumption culture, we were accused of embezzling, not officially, but our friends thought maybe we'd embezzled something because you were mucking out stalls at a horse barn as a volunteer 5 days a week, and I was volunteering with Oxfam and teaching five-year-olds English that spoke French. And, you know,
well, it was pretty funny, though. My good friend Paulo from Brazil, who worked with us in the company I used to run, he came visited in England, and I was up mucking out a horse stall at the stable where I was working. And he came, and he was standing there just in horror saying, you used to be such an important person. You used to be somebody, and now look at what you're doing. And I said, you know, Paulo, it's basically the same job I had before. It's just it was in a boardroom, not in a stable. So.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was much more agreeable, actually, and it smelled better.
So didn't have to put up with other people's
mm-hmm,
words.
That's right.
So I think, you know, for us, enough became a defining moment, and it became sort of the line in the sand. And we're still working at it. We haven't figured all of it out. In fact, we just did our annual plan for the next 2 years, and then we have a longer range plan And in that, we talked about how we're going to sort of deconstruct some other parts of our lives and sell some things and move on to the next phase of where we think we're going as we age. And that brings me to the point of, if you really want to have a life where you feel like you have enough and you want to sort of opt out of the consumption of society, the most important thing you can do is have a plan. And maybe, Jay, you could talk a little bit about how planning has impacted our move towards building a business and having a good life, a life that's pleasing to us.
Well, I think in any business and in any life, you know, if you don't know where you're going, how do you know you got there? You know, it's important to have your goals written out. They sort of become part of your subconscious. And it's also a good measure for me because I tend to be much more than Annie. I drift back into the world occasionally, and I'll start to worry about how we're going to pay our bills at some future date. Or
how horrible the TV is.
The television. Well, that's another thing. That's another issue is, aside from planning, you have to divorce yourself from those reoccurring messages that are really dysfunctional and will really mess with your mind. And television is a good example. I mean, one of the rules at Blue Rock Station is we would never have a television. And that was Annie's rule because, I would watch it, I have to admit.
It's not even visible. We have a TV to watch it.
Well, it's just not hooked up to anything. So, right. But it's but the television, Annie likes to refer to it as the Your Life Sucks machine because essentially, its whole motivation is to tell you, regardless of where you are, you should be dissatisfied because you don't own this thing, or you're never as beautiful or as successful as these people in these shows. So it really is designed to keep you in a constant state of dissatisfaction, because then you will go out and buy something to feel more satisfied with your miserable lot in life.
Well, Friends, the show Friends, which I pride myself in that I never watched, but I read somebody who was analyzing, that's the right word, analyzing, and they were saying that they could actually track different product lines that were in the show. So what they felt the message, for example, they had these dishes apparently that they set the table with. And when they opened the cupboard, they could see the dishes and then they put them on the table. And that people would go and buy these dishes. Every time the dishes appeared in the show, there would be a huge increase in the sale of those dishes. And so they interviewed people and they said, if I buy these dishes, then I'm going to have these kind of friends and they're going to come and eat with me and we're going to have this kind of a relationship. And in fact, they didn't at all. They just for a minute felt better about buying something and sort of filling that void in their life, which is not fillable because it's coming from the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this idea that you accumulate so much stuff that you need to go out and buy storage spaces to store all of the stuff because you can't use it. When you divorce yourself from it, it gets more and more bizarre. You know, in fact,
when you divorce yourself from what?
From this concept of more.
Oh.
You know, why on earth do you need a storage unit full of stuff that you can't use because it's in a storage space full of stuff? And I always think about, like, in most Aboriginal cultures, the concept of having everything you need and still wanting more and not sharing it is considered insanity. You know, I mean, if you have what you need, you share it with other people. That's society.
But that isn't the value we place in this
country. No, ours glorifies the insanity of having more than anyone else and wanting more still.
Well, I think too that the whole thing with Facebook, you know, and people getting angry about you know, the fact that you're getting tracked all the time and know all these things about you. That's just really another example that, you know, they're trying to drive home that you should buy these things and do these things. And they know specifically what you want. So you go look at something online and the next thing you know, it's appearing next to the stuff you're looking at, you know, saying, don't you want to buy this? And so we are being stalked in a lot of ways. And that's why we have to have a plan. Without a plan, you are not going to be able to succeed in stepping out of this society.
You are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. And we are once again reminding you that it is indeed the end of the world as we know it. And thank God.
And thank God.
That's right. Thank God.
So, well, let's talk about what life looks like under this philosophy, because it's really hard to sort of burrow down or drill down and make it sound like, you know, oh man, everything's so bad. And yes, things are really tough right now. I'm not going to say they're not. But for me, one of the things that I feel like I want to live a life where there's sort of an even flow. I don't like the drama of being in the culture and the, you know, like being on a roller coaster to be out in this culture all the time. And I'm not saying that I want to live like a hermit. I want to know about things, and I definitely want to know about books and movies and make new friends and all that. But I don't want to be told what to think and do. And so one of the ways that I'm able to detach from that society and have sort of a philosophy is that I like for people to gather together to bring food and conversation. For example, when it's my birthday, I don't really want to have presents. I don't want to have presents except maybe something from you. But I prefer to have time with my friends. So I have a birthday swap, which is my women friends and their girls come and bring stuff they don't want anymore. And we have almost all day of trading things and telling stories and sharing food. And it's such a gift often to nurture me the whole year of just remembering how much I laughed and some of the things that went on in those events. And we have a big party at Yule, which is the winter solstice, and lots of friends come and some of our former interns, and they stay the weekend, and the next day we choose the baby names for the goats. And so it's this whole process of creating opportunities for glue, which is what I think those events are, to hold us together and to cherish that relationship, because we live in a culture which is mostly about selfies and mostly about technology. And so we call friends on Facebook when we don't really even know these people, nor have we ever met them. So we have to create opportunities.
A lot of it will be simply your own self-talk. How do you define what success is? And it just reminded me, we had a tour group one time of it was half American students, high school students, and half Swedish high school students. And we were discussing different things, and somebody brought up the idea of the American dream. And the Swedish high school students had never heard that term, what is the American dream? So I asked the American high school students to define it, and they defined it in terms of things, you know, having a big car, having a big house, having lots of money. This was the American dream as they understood it and as they defined it. And it seemed to make sense to the Swedish students, but I asked them, do you have a Swedish dream that's similar to the American dream? And they said, oh, yes, you know, looking at the ocean, walking through the forest.
Didn't they call it the rights of man?
No, that was a different issue.
Okay.
But it was, you know, having meals with your family. To them, that was the dream. Yeah, the rights of man was essentially that nobody really owns property, that there is no such thing as private property, that you have the right to walk across, to share in other people's property, as long as you do not alter it.
You mean the land,
it.
Like
yeah,
the land.
Yeah, walk across, camp mm-hmm. on their property, things of that
this
nature.
This is very anti-American. I don't know how I
That's
feel about
right.
that.
I
no, I'm serious. I'm not that keen about that concept.
Mm-hmm.
But
share,
I like,
share alike.
I
yeah.
like the other stuff.
It's the Swedish dream, baby.
Well, okay, but maybe everybody mm-hmm. in Sweden is nice.
Uh-huh.
Well, one of the things that I think about, because we are often talking about these principles and how we can do better at our self-talk, particularly about enough, but is one time there was a group that came of little kids that lived in a pretty poor area, and they came with their moms and a minister. And so the kids were very excited about the animals and the bugs and everything at Blue Rock Station. And so we went in the house and sat down in the living room, which is quite amazing, especially little kids. And they started asking me a lot of questions. And then I said, well, I'm the richest woman in the world. And they went, oh, and they looked up at their moms. And one of the moms said, she doesn't mean it. She doesn't have money. She's just got stuff. And that was amazing to me because I said, no, that's not true. And I started talking about that I'd been walking to this place all my life and the value that I placed on my relationships and my spiritual practice and what I ate and all these things. And the kids were, they loved that. They could really see because that definition could fit for them. They had all those things. Maybe they didn't always have the food they wanted to eat, but they had all of these things in their own life, but they didn't have a bunch of money in the bank. Mm-hmm. So when we were walking back to the bus for the kids to go home, the woman who had kind of given me a hard time said, so I just want to know, what is it you gave up to live here? And I really had to laugh out loud, and I said, absolutely nothing, mm-hmm. because it's everything.
Well, and how we define wealth is such a bizarre thing. I remember my dad telling me, and he was an economist, but he would tell the story of this island in the Pacific, and wealth was measured by rocks, whoever had the most rocks, because rocks were scarce on this island, and that the richest family on the island owned a huge boulder that was under the sea that no one had ever seen.
Wow, just like America.
I know, and I thought, that is the most absurd thing. Well, the huge boulder that's under the sea that we believe in are actually electronic numbers in some bank account somewhere. I mean, there is no intrinsic value, just like there's no value in a rock that's under the ocean. It's just we give these things value. And, yeah. and in reality, they have no value except that you lend to them. So when you redefine what you view as being valuable, then a lot of this baggage that we carry around in our society just kind of fades away.
Well, I think part of the challenge, though, is that it's hard to look around and have your family or your friends to make judgments. And I know it was hard on us when people that we cared about would say, well, did you embezzle something or what did you do illegally?
Why are you running away?
Yeah, why are you running away? Why have you given up everything and sold your home and live in this mansion in France? And how is that possible? And the other part was that they really thought we were nuts. I know one of our friends who we had been friends with for a long time told me, you need mental health help. And when you find it, come back and I'll be your friend again.
Well, and that may have been true. It just wasn't about the whole wealth thing that was the mental health.
It was about issue. Coming back to this country and all the craziness that was going on.
Well, and we here tend to, you know, there's the old saying, you live to work. You know, you want to work to live.
That's the American dream.
You know, and that's a truism, and which one of my favorite little stories that we tell quite often is about the American tourist who's walking along the beach and he sees this guy laying on the beach in the sun next to a fishing boat. It's clear this guy's a fisherman, and the tourist says to this fisherman, he says, "What are you doing there?" And he goes, "I'm lying here in the sun." He goes, "Well, why aren't you fishing?" He says, "Well, I caught all the fish I need for today." He says, "Yeah, but why don't you catch more fish?" And he goes, "Well, what would I do with those?" And he goes, "You could sell them." And then what? He goes, "Well, you could buy another boat and you could hire someone and that person could fish for you and you could sell those fish and you would have more money." He goes, "What would I need that for?" And he says, "Well, you could retire and you could do anything you want." And he says, "Well, I want to lie here on the beach in the sun." And in such a simple little roundabout, but it really reinforces to me, you know, why are we waiting? Why are we pushing off to the future something we could experience today if we just get rid of all of the weird cultural messages that that kind of force us into a pattern.
Planning. All about making a plan.
Well, and for me, you know, and you've helped me a lot in this, of course, but I keep two words next to my computer on the desk now that help me keep reminding myself. And those two words are, the first is abundance. Because when I worry about money or the short-term aspect of that, the word abundance has so much tied up in it. You know, we have enough, and that's abundance. You know, and for today, life is abundant. And the second word is being. And I think that's important also, because I feel like in my life I've always been trying to become. You know, I'm going to become something. I'm going to work towards becoming something in the future. And it's okay to just be, you know, to be in the moment. Very, very zen.
Yeah. You know. But the other thing I just want to say is that sort of about a process is that even when our children were small, we would still go away for a day or two, go to the beach. And when they couldn't read and write yet, we would make pictures of what our goals were. And we would create goals for the whole year of places we wanted to visit or things we wanted to do, and then certainly financial goals. And the kids would make pictures. And this involved everybody. So our children had an idea of what is it we are about, what is it we want to do. And it's really interesting to watch our granddaughter, whom we raised from the beginning of life, and how
of,
she's
of her life, of not her the beginning life. Of
all right,
all
of
life.
Her life. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe. Yeah. Maybe life did start when I became a grandmother. I don't know. It sort of felt like it sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to have a plan, involve our kids, show them how it all works, and then try to stick to the plan as much as you can. Of course, it's impossible to do it entirely, but it's the getting there that's important.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the goals, maybe you want to tell a little bit about when we were first together, because I think it's kind of telling as to our personalities, because when we were first dating and starting to get a little bit serious, and you came to me, as you were wont to do, and said, well, we need to write down our goals for our life.
I know, because I was worried. I didn't know if I really wanted to be serious, that serious, and you were so serious, and so adorable. But anyway, so I wrote down.
How come you used the adorable in the past tense?
No, you were still adorable.
All right.
So anyway, so I said, you write down four things that are your goals for life, and I'll write down four things, and then we'll switch. And I was very nervous about it because you were from a very different background than me. And so you wrote down yours, and I wrote down mine. And so yours said.
Yeah, I said I want a Mercedes 350 SL red convertible. I want to be a millionaire before I'm 40. I want to learn to speak other languages, and I want to travel the world.
Yeah.
Those were my goals.
Yeah. And so then I wrote that I wanted to live in a house with laughter. It was 1980, so I wanted to be able to go to the store and get what I needed. I wanted to have a car that was economical and got good gas mileage and got me there. And I wanted to travel.
And I was looking at you thinking, a car that gets good gas mileage, a house filled with laughter, enough food to eat. And I even said to you, I said, these are easy.
And I said, they're everything. That's going to be hard.
Mm-hmm. And thus began our quest for the philosophy of enough.
So true.
You've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. Thanks for spending a bit of time with us. And as your grandmother should have told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and eat your veggies.
Eat those veggies. So, anyway, till next time. Goodbye.
And her children will be healed.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.